So, now it's my great delight to introduce Susan Piver. Susan is a New York Times best-selling author of 7 books, including the award-winning How Not to Be Afraid of Your Own Life and The Wisdom of a Broken Heart. She is an authorized teacher and meditation instructor in the Shambhala Buddhist lineage and has practiced meditation for 15 years. Susan leads retreats and teaches around the world. In 2011, Piver launched the Open Heart Project, which offers an online course of meditation instruction to thousands of at-home practitioners. So, at-home practitioners, so glad to turn it over now to Susan Piver. Susan, thank you so much for being here, and please offer some wisdom.
Thank you, Travis, and I am completely delighted to be here and to be a part of Shambhala Mountain Center's Awake in the World. Before I start talking about relationships, I do want to say that Shambhala Mountain Center is my favorite place in the world. The topic of relationships is probably my favorite topic in the world, and attempting to be awake in the world is by far my favorite activity. So this is a wonderful and delightful opportunity for me to speak with you. And it has also been really wonderful for me to get to talk to other Dharma teachers on this topic. I had a wonderful conversation with Susan Chapman that you can hear also about communication in relationships, which is, of course, the foundation of good relationships, and a completely delightful talk with the wonderful Dharma teacher Tara Brock about relationships from a Dharmic point of view, but it was also quite a personal conversation that we were able to have together. And there's also a talk on Four Immeasurables by Dr. Jerry Brazza. So altogether, I think you could get a good hit of Dharmic insight into the very complicated topic of relationships. As mentioned, I have been a meditation practitioner for 15 years, and I'm also married, and I've been married for about the same amount of time. And as we all know, relationships are terribly complex, but I don't know how I would survive in my relationship without Buddhist wisdom. And it is some of that wisdom that I want to share with you tonight. It seems that no matter how practiced we are, relationships are incredibly difficult for everyone. And even for Dharma practitioners who try to apply the Buddhist teachings in all areas of everyday life, you know, work and health and money and all the things that we all have to deal with as part of regular life, you know, I can apply the Dharma to those things, especially sort of the notion of impermanence, that everything changes. Okay, I have my work, I recognize that it's going to change. I have my health, I recognize that it's going to change. I have my bills, I hope they're going to change. And the one place that I find it very difficult to apply the notion of impermanence is to my own relationship. That must stay permanent. So, of course, that is not possible. But often a great breakdown occurs when it comes to matters of the heart in applying the Dharma. I find that very interesting. So in my own thinking about how I could apply Buddhist teachings to my relationship, I thought back to the core teachings of the Dharma, which, as probably many of you know, are based around the Four Noble Truths. So one day I guess I was like in a fight or something with my husband, and I was thinking, well, what could the Four Noble Truths be of relationships? Because I really need to know them right now. So I have my own idea, I'm going to share it with you in a moment, of what those noble truths are, and then 3 steps that we can all take to apply those truths. And before I get into that, I want to tell you that I made these things up. These are not things that the Buddha said or things that I read anywhere. They're things that arose in my own mind. So you must take them with a grain of salt and test them if you find them interesting. Test them in your own relationship life. And whatever applies, it is now your wisdom. And whatever doesn't apply, you are free to never think about again. So the first noble truth of relationships is that relationships are uncomfortable. Relationships are uncomfortable. And it sort of doesn't matter what stage of relationship you're at, even if you're going out on a date with someone that you have never met before. It's very uncomfortable. You think, well, what if they don't like me? What if they do like me? What if I don't like them? How am I going to get out? And what should I wear? And what about all my past relationships that were so miserable? And I'm nervous and uncomfortable. So even before you meet someone, you know, the potential for discomfort is very real. But I will tell you, as someone that has been married for 15 years or so, that there is also incredible discomfort, but it's a different kind of discomfort. It's more the discomfort of like, why are you doing that thing again that I asked you 9 million times not to do again? You just did it again. So there's this one thing that nobody really tells you about relationships, and this is not a bummer, even though it really sounds like it, is that they are full of irritation, everyday kinds of irritation. And at first, that can seem like, uh-oh, what's going wrong? Because I'm very irritated right now. But there's something about that rubbing up against another person in the efforts to live a daily life together that actually provides a kind of fire and warmth that is not unimportant. So the first noble truth, relationships are uncomfortable. And so if you are ever thinking, well, when am I ever going to get comfortable in this relationship, you know, I invite you to think the answer might be never. And that's okay. That is completely expected and not a bad thing. The second noble truth of relationships that I will posit to you is that thinking they should be comfortable is what makes them uncomfortable. And of course, we all long for love. And we don't long for it so that we can be uncomfortable. We long for it so that we can feel all the things that I don't need to name, you know, appreciated and validated and accepted and heard and embraced and truly wonderful things that I hope and pray from the bottom of my heart every single person who is watching this will find from love or has found. However, when most of us say we are looking for love, we don't really mean that. We mean we are looking for someone to love us, and then hopefully we will be able to love them back. Or we really mean I'm looking for some way to feel safe. And with this notion that I will find the person for me, and together we will sort of turn our backs on the tremendous difficulties and pain of everyday life, and find a way to cocoon ourselves in this love that will enable us to forego some of the pain of being a human. And it is, there is obviously a lot of pain in being a human. However, there is nothing safe about love. It is maybe the least safe thing there is. So the minute we start trying to make it safe, it stops being love. So it takes a lot of openness and courage and bigness of heart and mind to step into this situation that we actually have no guarantees will work out. So we sort of put our heart on a roulette wheel and spin the wheel. And that is how relationships are, and there's no way to make sure that it's going to turn out okay. Nonetheless, we try very hard to make our relationship comfortable for ourselves. And often that means a way for us to forget about the things that are difficult in our life. However, anyone who's been in a relationship for more than a minute can tell you that in many ways, a love relationship, an intimate relationship, shines a spotlight on the things that make us most uncomfortable. And again, there's may not be what we think is the ideal relationship, but there's also tremendous benefit in that. Tremendous heart and tremendous truth in being with someone who doesn't make us feel comfortable, but who shows us where our edges are. So the second noble truth is that thinking it's supposed to be comfortable is actually what makes it uncomfortable. So imagine that, what it would be like to enter a relationship, whether it was a date or a marriage or whatever it might be, having foregone the notion that it's supposed to be comfortable. It would be a whole different situation. So think about that. The third noble truth of relationships is that meeting the discomfort together is love. I thought, speaking for myself, that I would meet someone, we would fall in love, there would be good things, there would be bad things. We would have troubles getting to know each other, and there would be weird things like, what, you throw all your things on the floor? I don't like that. Or, you know, whatever the normal, very prosaic things are of a relationship. But that at some point, it would sort of even out, and we would be cool. But I would like to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that a relationship never stabilizes. It is always going like this. There are always times of great passion and intimacy and warmth and understanding and friendship, and then times of great distance and boredom and anger. And the weird thing is, one can't, or I can't, predict when a particular phase will happen. I can be an incredibly loving, kind, nice, awesome person and, you know, kind of get a blank stare back from my husband. And there can be other times where I show up as my, like, most cranky, puny, unpleasant self, and I just see the eyes of love gazing back at me from him. Or not. There's no telling. So it never, ever stabilizes. And therefore I say that meeting the discomfort, riding those waves, surfing that destabilized fact, or the fact of destabilization, is love itself. Because you may think, oh, you love someone because they're nice, they're smart, they're funny, they make you laugh, whatever it might be. And at first, that, you know, of course you love someone because they have wonderful qualities. But after a certain point in a relationship, you know, I will be perfectly frank that I can't really tell you what I feel about my husband anymore. I guess you could call it love, but it is so much more than that. We have times, as I was saying, where things are awesome and times where things are like, what? I don't even know you. But somehow, through this act of riding these waves together and standing in this crazy storm of love together, month after month and year after year, rather than feeling love for each other, I find that we are living in love itself. And the longer we are together, the stronger and bigger the container of love is. And the container of love can hold both feelings of love and feelings of distance and feelings of confusion. So it's the relationship itself that gives us love instead of the other way around. And that developed through this willingness, whether we knew this is what we were signing up for or not, to ride these waves together. So just to summarize, I'll say that it has nothing to do with what you feel about each other that makes a relationship loving. But if you can find someone who will stand shoulder to shoulder with you and look together at these crazy waves of passion and distance and chaos and doubt and affection and who knows what, that is the best we can ask for, and it is pretty friggin' good. I will say that. That's a good relationship, to find someone who will stand with you in this maelstrom. So that's the third noble truth. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a way to work with it all. So it's not just like showing up and hoping for the best. Someone said things are going to be crazy and uncertain, but, you know, let me just hope that things work out. There's actual steps that you can take. There are things that you can do to strengthen your capacity as a lover, as someone who loves. So there are three, I believe I said. And the first, and these are also based in some my views of Buddhist wisdom called the three yana view, Y-A-N-A. And the first step that I think is very important for everyone to take in relationships is what I would put under the heading of precise. To be very precise in certain ways about the way you are with the person you love, about the way you are with yourself in a love relationship. And by precision, I mean things that are very simple, but actually not easy. Precision means things like having good manners, but I mean like deeply good manners. Deeply good manners are rooted in a foundation of thoughtfulness, and thoughtfulness means thinking of the other person in addition to yourself. So there's no such thing as good manners without being able to place your mind in the other person's experience. It can mean things as simple, however, as if you say you're going to show up at 9, you show up at 9. And if you think you're going to be late, you call. You know, it's amazing how little things like that can actually destabilize and cause distrust and pain if you don't do the things you say you're going to do. It means you tell the truth skillfully, not stupidly. It means you represent yourself accurately and you declare your intentions honestly as you know what they are, not that they have to stay the same. But if you are with someone who can't sort of rise to this very basic level of good manners, of showing up, of being honest, of being who they say they are, then there's not much hope there. There's not really very far you can go without that basic ground level of decency and good manners that are predicated on this kind of precision, really being thoughtful and clear and present in your relationship. So the first step is to be precise. The second step is to be open. And I'll tell you what I mean by that in 1 second. What I mean by that is that in your relationship, you look at the other person, wait for it, as being at least as important as you are in the relationship, and maybe even a little bit more important. I must say that when I fell in love and made a commitment to a relationship, I was actually quite surprised to find there was another person there, in a sense, that had their own needs and their own confusion and their own... I guess I thought, well, this is really good for me, about me in some way, but no. In fact, the more you are able to place your attention on the other person's experience in the relationship, not to abandon your own and lose sight of it, because that would be very destabilizing for both of you, but the more you can sort of take your mind off of exactly how everything is affecting you and place it with great generosity on the other person to see how things are affecting them, the more warmth there will be in your relationship. As I said earlier, when most of us say we're looking for love, we're sort of really looking for someone to love us or a way to feel safe, and feeling safe is not an option. So even though it's very hard to sort of give that up, the only way to find a sense of power in love is not in waiting for someone to love us, but as a lover. That is the only seat of power. And I'm not saying overpowering or aggressively powerful, but the seat of power and stability and grace is as a lover, as opposed to one who is waiting for love. So you can always find a way to put love into any situation, and that is by offering it. And there's no circumstance where that is not possible. Of course, sometimes love looks like sweetness and light, and sometimes it looks like I'm out. So it's up to you to figure out which one is appropriate. I once, a long time ago, was in a relationship. I had a boyfriend. I was like a teenager. I was really young. And I lived in another country. We lived together. And I thought, well, I really loved this person, and I knew he loved me. But I thought, well, am I going to live in this foreign country for the rest of my life? Or I'm not really sure. Is this it? Is this my life right now? I don't know if I'm ready to make this sort of step. So we had many conversations about whether I should stay or go. And we would stay up night after night just like crying together because we really loved each other. But we were very young. And at one point in one of these conversations, he said, I think you should go home. And I was sort of surprised because, again, I knew he really loved me and didn't want me to leave. And I said, what makes you say that right now? It still makes me tear up, actually, to think about this. He said, because I love you more than I love us. That's a good boyfriend. That is a noble way to love. And again, it's not anything about neglecting yourself or abandoning yourself or martyring yourself because that's silly and stupid and nobody should do those things. but to somehow place your love for the person a little bit above your love of your relationship with them changes everything, creates enormous space and opportunity for great kindness. So open is the second step. And the third step, and this is the last step, and I would love to hear your questions or comments, so please feel free, is what could fall under the heading of beyond. And what this means is that you make some sort of commitment or effort or intention to use everything that happens in your relationship as a possible means for deepening intimacy. And that is always possible. And that is the fantastic news about love, if you ask me. I want to say parenthetically, although very important, this has nothing to do, if you're in an abusive relationship, these things don't apply in the same way. And the way to deepen intimacy, perhaps, in that sort of relationship is to leave. So please don't think that this means putting up with bullshit. When you fall in love, it's the most wonderful thing in the world. And I think there are people out there that think it's some sort of weird, delusional state. But I don't think it is. I think it's real, and I think it's wonderful, and I think it's, if it happens to you, it's like being transported to a wonderful, wonderful place that is no less real than the place that we're in right now. And I hope that it has happened or will happen for every single one of you. However, that always ends. The feeling of falling in love and the tremendous and real and beautiful, poignant, pure, fantastic romance of falling in love always ends. However, intimacy has no end, and it is something that you can commit to for your whole life. And with the wish or commitment to use whatever happens between you and this other person as a means to deepen intimacy, creates a foundation for a relationship that can last a lifetime and has nothing to do with kittens and flowers and, you know, doesn't even necessarily have that much to do with feelings of love, but everything to do with being loving. And even though no one can commit to feel love time, even though in many marriage ceremonies you are asked to commit to that, everyone can commit to being loving. That is real. And that is rich. The foundation for being able to take these steps, and not just to set these intentions, but to manifest them and live them, is the practice of meditation. There's no question in my mind that without a contemplative practice, without a meditation practice, it's very, very difficult to actually do these things. And it's not that meditation practice makes you a better person. It makes you more loving. But not because it teaches you any particular skills necessarily, although it's a very profound and beyond profound practice. It's because the things, and this is the last thing I want to say, so I'll look forward to your questions. The things that we treasure most in this world, wisdom, and insight, and creativity, and of course, love, all have one thing in common. They are not things that we can go out and get. No matter how smart we are, or how good our plan is, or how willful we feel about being or getting any of these things, you can't get those things. These are all things that arise, and they arise when we make space. So these are things that we receive. They are not things we can go out and get. And the practice of meditation teaches us how to create this space of receptivity within ourselves and to stabilize it. And into that space can cascade the things we long for most. So I will just close by saying I wish for you those things. And Please also give the other talks in this series and relationships a chance, because I think taken together they offer a really, really interesting and rich body of insight into how to love. So what do you say? Thank you. Questions? The first question is, how can you engage in love without indulging in unhealthy attachment? Well, that's a very good question. Sometimes when people say unhealthy attachment or non-attachment, and this may not be what you, questioner, means, is how can I not be affected by things that upset me? How can I be upset less? How can I somehow sort of not be so invested and desirous of love and being treated well and being happy and so on? And, you know, I don't think that's what non-attachment means. I think it's no problem to engage in love without attachment, but that doesn't mean without caring or somehow finding a way to be implacable and unaffected. Here, non-attachment means when things are deeply loving, you allow that and you soak in it. And when that love starts to fade, you ride that wave and you allow that too. So, you know, of course, we all want to hold on to the things that make us feel good and ward off the things that could make us feel bad. But non-attachment means not doing that. Actually not having a preference. And of course, we do have a preference. We want to feel good. We don't want to feel bad, and that's good. But it means riding the waves, as I spoke about earlier. And that is non-attachment. So you can absolutely engage in love without unhealthy attachment, which would mean insisting that things always be a certain way. So I hope that's useful. Next question. I love this question. Can I make a relationship work even if my partner does not share my Buddhist view? My partner does not share my Buddhist view. So I would say yes. In some ways it's easier when your partner shares your path. In some ways it's not easier. So I have known many couples who both share a path, and I find that they are sometimes get lost in sort of jargon and view and somehow lose a kind of heart in the way they relate to each other, you know, from time to time. I find in my relationship that I cannot do any talking. I can only walk. I have to walk the talk of being a Buddhist, and I can't say anything about, can't you see how compassionate I'm being, or can't you practice more, you know, loving kindness toward me or something? And I'm not suggesting that's what you are doing, but I have to be a Buddhist. I have to be loving and be compassionate and have sympathetic joy and be equanimous. And that is more important, I would say, by far, than anything. So, you know, sometimes you think, well, I'm doing all these things. I'm being nice and open and beyond and precise and so forth. But this other person isn't, and they don't understand. You know, I just heard this talk and or whatever. I think this is the right thing to do. How can I get them to do it when they don't read what I read or think what I think? And the way to do that is to be those things. That is far more magnetizing than any conceptual sharing of a viewpoint that you can do. So I hope that's useful. Why do we get bored in relationship? How can we deal with that? Well, my friend, if I knew the answer to that question, I would be taking you all to dinner tonight. In meditation practice, there's an analogy, because if you are a meditator, or anyone who's meditated for more than like a week, finds that at first it's like, oh, this is cool. I'm finding this new way to work with my mind. And then shortly thereafter finds, and it's really boring. I find that I'm thinking about what's for lunch all the time, and aren't I supposed to be becoming enlightened, and so on. So we live in a world of vast entertainments, and you know, sometimes relationships are boring and that you've run out of steam and it's over. So, you know, that happens. But other times, and I have something I want to say that may be a little bit controversial or off topic even, but other times it's because we are so used to sort of being full of insights and inputs and advertisements and possibilities, and especially when you're falling in love, you don't have to seek, obviously, for any excitement. It's there the moment you wake up and even while you're asleep. And when it leaves, real everyday life is kind of boring. So finding a way to stay with that is interesting. I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing. It's an interesting thing, and that interesting is different than good or bad. And Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, the meditation master that brought the Shambhala teachings to us, that's the lineage I practice in, described something in meditation called cool boredom, which is a very good sign, a sign that your mind is ceasing to look for entertainment and actually entering a state, the beginning of a state of relaxation. So you could think about that. And the semi-controversial thing I want to say is, harking back to what I said earlier about needing my relationship to be permanent, well, it's not going to be permanent. Someone's going to fall out of love or decide they don't want to be in a relationship for some reason, or, of course, you know, someone's going to die. And oddly, that's the best case scenario. So it's very painful to contemplate that. And the more you love, the more untenable and unthinkable that eventual parting becomes. And my opinion, this is purely my opinion, is that most relationships at this point end because, not because, oh, you're not ambitious or you're too ambitious or whatever it might be, but because it's too hard to face that. What you are building will end. And sometimes I think the boredom is a way of not looking at that. So again, I'm not saying that you, questioner, are in that place, but it's complicated, and I think that's something important to think about. How do you identify a person who is likely to be open to riding the waves of a relationship and standing in love? Well, thank you very much for using my words in this question. I appreciate you listening that closely. Unknown. Impossible. You know, I don't think I was that kind of person when I got into a relationship, but together I think we became that kind of person. So maybe you or another person is not that way now, but it's sort of a way that you become together. But I would go back to that first category of skill when it comes to relationships, the precise category, because if a person is decent and trustworthy and shows up at 9 when they say 9 or whatever it is it might be, I think there's a lot of potential there, a lot of possibility. But if that level is missing, then this other part is unlikely to occur. So good luck with that. Do we need relationships to, quote, wake up? What about solitary traditions? No, I don't think we need relationships to wake up. I don't think relationships are for everyone. In fact, I don't think they're for a lot of people. You know, I think we're all brought up to believe that we should be in a relationship, but honestly, it's very difficult, and it's a profound practice, and it might not be the best practice for everyone. However, if you're in a tradition that really focuses on the cultivation and generation and offering of compassion, of bodhicitta, there is no better crucible than an intimate relationship, because that is where the ability and willingness to be compassionate seems to end most quickly, is with the person that you actually do love. So if your practice is compassion, you don't have to be in an intimate relationship, but it is a very fruitional step to take in this bodhisattva path. And solitary traditions, I think, have just as much opportunity for waking up as relationships. Depends on who you are and your karma. do you have any tips for dealing with a broken heart? I do, because I wrote a whole book about that called The Wisdom of a Broken Heart. Because I was, what had happened to me, again, you know, pretty long time ago, but I never forgot it. Because, and I'm talking about the kind of broken heart I assume you're talking about, which is you can't breathe, you can't eat, you can't think. Your life has just shrunk to this one fact of how, of this person not being with you anymore. And it's, I think, among the most horrific pains that a person can experience. And at the same time, it's so ordinary. It happens to most people, which is shocking because it is very debilitating. So, you know, and in the book, I sort of suggest three, again, sort of things you can do. And the first is to stabilize, find a way to stabilize your mind, because one of the hallmarks of heartbreak from lost love is something I like to call insane, obsessive thinking. Why did you do this? Shouldn't I have done that? If only I had said this. It's because I was stubbed my toe when I was six and all these things happened. And it's really hard to stop that. And step one is not stopping that, because that would be like probably impossible and a gesture of aggression, but finding a way to relax with that and stabilize it, which the practice of meditation is very, very good for. And finding some way to relate with the shame that seems to arise with this kind of broken heart through loving kindness practices, I think, is very, very helpful. But, you know, you don't have to be a Buddhist or spiritual even to do these things. They're just ways of working with this profound energy of the heart. And I would also just offer to you that what I found from writing this book about heartbreak and actually traveling all over North America talking about it to many, many people with broken hearts and my own broken heart and so on, my friends, I've come to the conclusion that heartbreak itself is actually not different than love. It is love unbound from an object. And unbound from an object, it roars. And it takes us by complete surprise. But it is not a sign of brokenness. It is a sign of the tremendous power of your heart. So I wish you healing. Oh, another one. Okay. This is the last one? Okay, last one. You've spoken a lot about relationship and being in love. What about other relationships that are of sustenance? How do we balance meeting others where they are with starting where we are in a relationship? I'm going to read that again. Other relationships. I don't know if I understand the question. I'm sorry. I'll start with the first part because I do understand that. I've spoken a lot about relationships and being in love. What about other relationships that are of sustenance? Yes, the more relationships that are loving and sustaining that we can have, the better. That's great. And we can only meet others where they are. There's really no other option. And we can only start where we are in a relationship. So if I understand, and I'm afraid I probably don't understand the meaning of your question, but there's an inevitability. There's no need to balance meeting others where they are because it's the only option. So thank you for that question, and I wish I could have given you a better answer. So to close, I want to thank you for being showing up to listen to this talk, and to remind you that there are other wonderful talks about this topic from Susan Chapman and Tara Brach and Jerry Braza, and to please come back tomorrow where the theme of the day is work, waking up in work. And it's led by a wonderful person who is a dear friend and a great writer and a fantastic teacher and in the vanguard of young Buddhist teachers named Lodro Rinzler. And you will absolutely enjoy hearing his point of view and having him walk you through the fascinating topic of waking up in work. So to you.